Last week, I assigned to you a homework related to those questions present in the last text of the exam we have seen on Friday. At now, no sheet, no answers have arrived by email, so I think that maybe you have no time or you are not interested to such a kind of work, so we can skip to the next exercises and eventually you will provide me the answers at the exam. Now, let's consider the exam given in January 29th, 2019. You can find the text and description of the process into the file MEC 290119. And let's take a look to this process into which a controlled system based on heat cooling mechanism for an environment is obtained by filling a tank with water, with hot water if we want to heat, with cold water if we want to cool, and this water is circulated by means of a turbine that is managed through a direct current motor. The amount of the heated or cold water filled into the tank causes a greater or lower cooling heating of the surrounding air that arrives on a tube, and this tube is located close to the environment, to the room, to the chamber, whose temperature must be controlled. This one, I mean this room, this chamber, this environment, will receive the correspondent thermal energy by convection, and depending on the level of the water present into the tank, we will regulate the temperature in the target environment. The motor can be considered similar to a direct current motor. Therefore, the exercise asks, draw the block scheme of the acquisition regulation chain, identifying input and output variables in every block, and in particular the process variable. Then calculate the transfer function of the process, highlighting what variable must be known. Then plot the Bode diagram of the loop function, considering the process and the actuator. By definition, we suppose that the transducers and their electronic circuits don't influence the transfer function of the acquisition chain, and discuss the eventual problems in terms of stability and instability. Therefore, in case of instability, we have to propose a suitable solution, describing it as usual in terms of new Bode diagram, numerical implementation, and so on. Explain what is the significance of the common mode reaction factor and how it is possible to determine it. Then how is it possible to estimate the time between the selection of one channel in input to an analog to digital converter and the next one using a multiplexer unit controlled by a microprocessor. Moreover, illustrate with completeness the motivations that bring to the equivalent electric model of a direct current motor, and what considerations allow to simplify it in case of voltage current driving. And finally, what is the transfer function of an oil pump driven by an electromagnetic actuator? Should the actuator be magnetized or not? These are the questions that are requested in such a kind of exercise of exam. Okay, let's consider the solution that you will find in the file Sol January 29, 2019. First of all, what is the process variable? Clearly, we want to control, to manage the temperature in the environment that is close to the tube, irradiated with the cold or warm air. Therefore, PV, the process variable, is the temperature of the environment. About the electrical driver, the text says that turbine fills the tank with the water and is driven by a motor which can be considered similar to a direct motor. Therefore, we have not the problem of considering weights, frictions, inertia, and we can conclude that our motor will be managed by the input voltage and will provide in output the angular rotation characterizing its own shaft. But as we know, the jump, let's say, from the angular rotation velocity and the temperature seems quite problematic, seems quite big. In other words, if we consider the manipulated variable, we cannot be satisfied if we write omega, because we have to relate omega with the temperature. But in the text, a suitable path is suggested. In fact, if we consider the actuator, we can say that the rotation velocity will influence clearly the flow rate with which the tank will be filled. Consider that the tank is characterized in the bottom by a hole, and clearly the water will exit from the tank through this hole. The pump, driven by the turbine, is able to take that water that exits from the tank and fill again it into the tank itself. So we have a circulation of the water in such a kind of a hydraulic circuit. Clearly, we want to regulate the volume of water that is present into the tank, and after having considered the output flow rate from the tank as fixed, we have to regulate the input flow rate through the motor so as to obtain at the end the desired level of water into the tank, the desired volume. The volume, on turn, can be considered as a thermal energy source. If we have a mass of warm water, clearly this will provide a certain degree of heat in the surrounding environment, and vice versa if this water is very cold, perhaps is frozen. So, the amount of water in the tank represents our thermal energy source. And this thermal energy is sent through irradiation to the tube, influencing its own temperature. Since the tube is close to the environment that we want to put under control, the temperature of the tube will affect the temperature of the environment. We will see how to model such a kind of influence. Therefore, we can write that the gain in the overall acquisition chain, considered as the ratio between the temperature in the environment divided by the power supply voltage, can be split into the ratio of the temperature of the environment divided by the manipulated variable times the manipulated variable divided by the power supply voltage. And in turn, we can split such a couple of ratios into a series, into a cascade, we can say, of divisions as represented into the solution. The first is the ratio between the temperature in the environment we want to control divided by the temperature in the tube. Then we have the ratio between the temperature in the tube divided by the thermal energy of the tank, given by the water into the tank, I mean. Then we have the ratio between the thermal energy inside the tank divided by the volume of the water filled into it. Then we have the ratio between the volume of the water and the flow rate as the difference between the flow in input and the flow in output. And the flow clearly is affected, is influenced by the rotational velocity of the motor, and the rotational velocity of the motor is determined by the voltage power supply. So, a set of terms that must be considered, and again, we achieve the lesson that when we are dealing with such a kind of problem, the best approach, the best solution is try to simplify it, is try to split it into a set of small problems that can be solved on a, let's say, step-by-step basis. In fact, considering the motor, we can say, as well known, that the relationship between the rotational velocity of the motor and the power supply voltage is a low-pass filter, K1 divided by 1 plus S tau, the constant of time of the motor. Moreover, about the tank, we have to make a set of considerations. The first one is, what is the relation between the output flux, I mean the output flux from the turbine, and the input flux in the tank? Clearly, the flux is proportional to the velocity of the water. The velocity of the water that enters into the tank. And in turn, this velocity will be proportional to the rotational velocity of the motor that drives the turbine. That is, flux divided omega is a constant, K2. Conversely, the volume of the water that remains into the tank is given by the difference between what is entering and what is exiting. And clearly, this is given by the integral function of the input flux minus the output flux. So, we can write vol tank equal to integral of the flux in input minus the flux in output. Consider that the flux in output can be represented in such a kind of model as a disturbance. Therefore, we can manage it with a suitable feed-forward compensation block. that, however, must be equipped with a transducer that measures the output flow rate. Otherwise, no compensation is possible. Moreover, the thermal energy that the tank can provide to the tube, so as to determine the temperature in the room that we want to manage, to control, is proportional to the amount of water that we have into the tank. So we can write K3 multiplying the volume of the water filled into the tank. Perfect. And now let's consider the tube. The tube features a suitable temperature. This temperature is related to the thermal energy provided by the water as, let's say, a typical thermodynamic phenomenon into which we provide a certain amount of energy. Part of this energy is lost into the environment due to some dispersion effects, and a part of this energy is exploited to determine the variation of the temperature into the environment. Therefore, we know that after some calculations, we can represent such a function as a low-pass filter, K4 divided by 1 plus SRC. We remember that R is the representation, the modelization of the dispersion, and the C is the model of the accumulation of the energy in the process so as to cause the variation of the temperature. Consider, however, that there is a certain distance between the tank and the tube, and that the thermal energy is transferred from the source to the target through an irradiation phenomenon, physical phenomenon. This irradiation phenomenon requires time, and depending on the closeness of the tube to the tank, we can consider the presence of a delay, e power minus s tau. And what about the environment? We could make a lot of considerations. I think that we have enough accurately described the system. So in a first approximation, we can say that the temperature of the tube is directly proportional to the temperature of the environment we want to control. However, we should consider, even in this case, a phenomenon of diffusion of the heat in the target room, in the target environment, and probably also in this case we should add a new low-pass effect or a delay. But, okay, that's enough for the moment. That's enough because if we assemble all these considerations and transfer functions of the small blocks we have considered, we see that G can be written as K5 that multiplies K4 divided by 1 plus SRC, multiplying E power minus S tau, that multiplies another constant K3 time 1 divided S time K2 time K1 divided by 1 plus S tau, the time constant of the motor. So we have a quite complex system with a pole into the origin, two poles in the frequency corresponding to the time constant of the motor and the time constant of the thermal process, and a delay. So, generally speaking, the situation is clearly not stable. The Bode diagram that we have shown in the solution goes from a slope equal to minus 20 dB per decade up to minus 40 and even minus 60. Therefore, we have the risk to cross the 0 dB axis with one of these two last slopes. That is the condition for claiming that the asymptotic stability is not possible. But we know how to solve this problem because a simple compensation with two functions. The first with a zero located in the same frequency of the process, divided by a suitable pole. 1 plus SRC divided by 1 plus SP1. And the second block with a zero that is located at the frequency corresponding to the time constant of the motor, and a pole that is located somewhere in the high frequencies range. 1 plus S tau M divided by 1 plus SP2. This couple of transfer functions allow to perform a compensation that will extend the bandwidth of the process and will allow to cross the 0 dB axis with a slope minus 1, so permitting to us to say that the system up to that frequency is asymptotically stable, is stable. And that's all. Also, the implementation is quite straightforward because we can split these two transfer functions into blocks, 1 plus SRC divided 1 plus SP1, and the second block 1 plus S tau M divided 1 plus SP2. And these two blocks are classic numerical blocks that implements the zero pole transfer function already seen in several situations described previously. We have a delay, but we know that the delay can be compensated and its effect can be eliminated through a Smith predictor. In the solution I have shown a small picture with certain set of memory blocks N, and the delay that we have to obtain will be the product of these blocks times the clock period that we use to cause the transfer of every information from the present block, the present register, to the next one in the sequence that characterizes the memory block for the delay. This is a solution that is suitable if the delay we are considering is not so high, or if the clock that we are using is not so high. So, for example, if the irradiation takes place in, let's say, 100 milliseconds or 1 second, if we have a clock time equal to 1 millisecond, clearly we will need 100 memory blocks or even 1000. That is not a big, let's say, problem. If instead the clock should be considerably lower, for example, let's say 1 microsecond or even lower, clearly the amount of the number of the blocks needed for implementing the delay grows up, and therefore the second solution we have described, I mean the cascade of low-pass blocks, should be considered preferable. But this is not enough, because in terms of overall compensation, this block, this Smith predictor, must be included into a suitable numerically implemented transfer function, that is 1 minus e power minus s tau divided by s, 1 plus rc and 1 plus s tau m. In the solution, I have shown the graphic solution of this implementation because it is quite straightforward. It is made of some blocks, and we know how to implement every block from the numerical point of view. The only thing that we have to accept is that such a kind of implementation could be not long, but could be consistent even in terms of, let's say, elaboration times. But we start from the hypothesis that the microprocessor we are using is enough quick, enough powerful to perform these calculations in time that is, let's say, not a problem for the control of the processor. Now let's consider the other questions that the exam asks to us. The first one is related to the common mode rejection ratio factor. This is a topic that has been explained during the period into which we considered the conditioning networks. Therefore, we have to go to the slide 23, and we have to recover the notes that we have taken at that epoch that explain what is the significance of the CMRR factor, how it can be calculated, the definition as the ratio between the differential gain and the common rain, the common gain in an instrumentation amplifier, for example, but generally speaking in a generic electronic circuit, and how it is possible to identify it by looking at the part of the transfer function that multiplies, or better, amplifies the difference between the input voltages and the part of the circuit that instead multiplies, amplifies the common part, that is the average of the two inputs to the electronic circuit that we are considering. Question number five is related to a specific situation that is interesting in my opinion to comment, and we have to go to the slide 25 of the conditioning network blocks, into which we have seen the typical interface between a microprocessor and a transducer, or better, a set of transducers. Generally speaking, we see that the acquisition can be performed by considering a multiplexer that allows to switch between many possible input variables, many possible transducers. Every input coming from the transducer is sampled, is held, and sent to an analog digital converter for the let's say transformation into a corresponding binary number that can be acquired, managed, elaborated by the microprocessor. We have repeatedly said that the sample and hold unit is not mandatory, is not necessary, in particular if the signal that we are acquiring by from the microprocessor is quite slow with respect to the conversion velocity, or if we are not interested to a sampling, let's say, campaign that allows to us to reconstruct the shape of the particular magnitude related to this signal. In these two cases, there is no need for a sample and hold unit. But in any case, let's consider the worst case. The question is related to the fact that the microprocessor should select each one of the input channels to the multiplexer. Therefore, it must send a suitable command to the multiplexer, switching from S1 to S2 to S3 to S4 to S5 up to the end. Clearly, this sequence of commands must respect a suitable synchronization. And this synchronization is defined, let's say, by the times of the components that are present between the multiplexing unit and the microprocessor itself. In other words, we have to consider that when selected, the multiplexer needs a certain time, maybe very short, maybe microsecond, to perform the commutation from the present channel to the next one. After this, the microprocessor, if necessary, will send a control command to the sample and hold unit. That is, a suitable switch will be closed, a capacitor will be charged with a certain amount of voltage signal, and after this time the switch will be open. All these operations require time, short, but they require time. We have another component that must be considered. And finally, we have the conversion time of the ADC. We didn't go into the details about the technology on which these converters are based, but we can have conversion times ranging from microseconds up to milliseconds. Therefore, these components must be considered because probably they can be the most important ones in the overall acquisition and conversion chain. After this time has elapsed, the microprocessor can select the next channel. So the summation of all these components determines the amount of time the microprocessor must wait before switching from one channel to the next one. Question number six is related to the motivations that justify the equivalent circuit of a direct current motor. We can go to the section relative to the actuators, and we can consider a suitable slide into which these motivations are clearly presented. The slides that we are considering are the number 15 and the number 16 and 17 and 18 for the next considerations. First of all, we remember that the nature of the motor is inductive, so we must consider the presence of an inductive effect that will bring a phase shift between the input magnitude we provide to the motor and the output response it gives, it provides. Second, we have to consider that the nature is inductive, but basically the motor features a great amount of wires, so we have to consider a resistive dispersion effect, but also those losses that are due to friction, inertia, mechanical effects. And if you remember, these effects have been represented by capacitors and big resistors. All these considerations brought to develop a model that is the one represented in slide 16 and in slide 17 of this actuator section. Now we have said that the direct current motor can be driven regulating the current or regulating the voltage provided in input. But depending on the particular choice we make, suitable simplifications can be made in the circuit. In particular, if we drive the motor through the voltage, we can neglect the inductors, because the two-time constant that will characterize the equivalent circuit are the first consisting on the resistance representing the dispersion due to the friction, and the capacitor representing the accumulation of energy necessary to the motor for overcoming the natural inertia, natural opposition to the movement. The other time constant is the one that is given by the inductor, but clearly the first one, due to mechanical effects, is bigger, is more consistent, more important in terms of effects onto the process, and therefore the second time constant can be neglected, and this suggests us to, let's say, cancel the L in the electronic equivalent model. Another consideration is related to the ideal generator that represents the effective torque that the motor can develop onto the process, and since this is a constant ideal current generator, it doesn't influence the transfer function of the motor, therefore is not considered in the final representation. Conversely, if the motor is driven by controlling the current, a further simplification can be done, because the small resistor R is in series with the resistance of the current generator I, that clearly is infinite because we consider an ideal current generator, and therefore can be eliminated by the circuit itself. The two transfer functions that we obtain are basically two low-pass filters, but the constants that are present in the two expressions are, of course, different. The last question is related to a pump, and specifically requires the transfer function of a pump into which the driving mechanism is managed through an electromagnetic actuator, and into the pump a certain amount of oil is present just to help the movement of the pump itself. The answer depends on what is the output that the pump must regulate, or if you want, that we want to control using the pump. Is the flux or is the pressure? In the first case, the electromagnetic actuator will develop a force that is proportional to the current, but this force in part will turn out into an effective force applied to the process, minus a certain degree of, let's say, loss due to the viscosity of the oil, and we can represent this loss through the product of the friction, the viscosity factor gamma, times the velocity of the movement. If the output is the pressure, this pressure is proportional to the force, to the effective force developed by the motor. Remember that the pressure is a force applied on a surface. If instead we are interested to control the flux is proportional to a velocity. And remember that the force is proportional to the acceleration of the movement. Therefore, the relationship between the flux and the effective force exerted by the actuator is an integral function. Finally, we can conclude that if the output variable, the manipulated variable, we could say, is the flow rate, the transfer function is 1 divided by S, that multiplies the product of a constant by the current, that is the force of the electromagnetic actuator, minus the viscosity term. Instead, if the output is the pressure, this integral function disappears. And finally, just to conclude about the question, is magnetized or not? You know, if the actuator, if the rod into the actuator is magnetized, we can decide if the rod will exit or will enter into the actuator, depending on the sign of the current that we are applying. If instead the rod is not magnetized, it will be immediately magnetized by the current in the solenoidal circuit that will give origin to a magnetic field that will magnetize the rod. In this case, the only movement that we can exert is an output movement, a movement that makes the rod to exit from the solenoidal circuit. So the answer is, it depends on the process. If the process requires a bidirectional movement, the first solution, that is a magnetized rod, is preferable. Instead, if the movement that we need to control is only one, that is a pushing force toward the external direction with respect to the solenoidal circuit of the actuator, the rod can be even not magnetized. Okay, another exercise that we can consider is the one relative to the exam given on January 29th, 2016. In this case, we considered the airbags for skiers and motorcyclists. These airbags allow, in many cases, to reduce the shocks due to the falls, if not even to save the life of the athlete. They consist of accelerometers and gyroscopes that allow to a microprocessor to establish the exact athlete's posture, eventually anomalous in case of a fall, together with a GPS system that monitors the athlete on all the track. The accelerometers provide to the microprocessor a three-axial information that is interpreted as postured, maintained correctly, or lost, and therefore as a possible fall. In this case, the microprocessor will inflate the airbag proportionally to the deceleration revealed by the sensors. The inflation of the airbag is obtained by injecting a current inside a fuel tank, typically nitrogen, that quickly explodes. The microprocessor regulates that current intensity, so as the higher the current, the faster the inflation of the airbag. In this case, the text is very useful because it clearly indicates what is the process variable, that is the acceleration. Moreover, the manipulated variable is the current that at a certain point is injected into the airbag so as to cause an explosion and a quick inflation of the airbag itself that protects the athlete from damages, in particular to the neck and to the head. Therefore, we could consider the manipulated variable as the current that is injected into the airbag, but even the explosion, if we could measure it. But in particular, again, reading the text, the variation of the pressure in the time, the derivative function, due to the fact that on the basis of the acceleration that we measure, we have to, let's say, fill more or less quickly the airbag itself. And the control variable will be a number. What kind of number? Consider that we have to regulate the amount of the current that we are injecting, and the possible circuit that allows to do it is shown in the solution that I have put on the website. Here you can see that the microprocessor will propose, let's say, a number in output that will be converted by a DAC device into a suitable voltage, and for example through a very simple and elementary resistor circuit we have a current that will cross the resistor R2 and will enter into the airbag, so inflating it, causing the explosion of the nitrogen. Therefore, this means that the control variable is the number that the microprocessor exits in output towards the digital to analog converter. Okay, we can write at this point a possible gain of the acquisition and the control chain that is given by the ratio between the acceleration and the pressure time the pressure divided by the current. The first relationship can be expressed as K divided by S. Why this? Because we said that correspondingly to the acceleration that we are measuring, we will cause a variation in the pressure that must be quicker or faster or slower depending on the deceleration that we are measuring. And this means that we have an integral relationship between the pressure and the current that we are injecting. From the text, in fact, we read that the higher the current, the faster will be the inflation of the airbag. This can be translated as writing an equation that is I equal to the derivative function of the pressure, that in Laplace is P divided by I equal to 1 on S. Concerning the relationship between the acceleration and the pressure, as a first approximation, we can say that we will have a lookup table that will associate the possible values of the pressure with the possible damages suffered by the athlete due to the deceleration after the fall. We could also make the hypothesis of a possible delay due to the explosion of the nitrogen. Clearly, we have to suppose a very short delay. However, because otherwise the athlete will suffer permanent damages since the control is out of the time range into which the event is happening. In other words, if the explosion is too slow, the athlete will fall and will suffer the shock onto the particular part of his body that will be hurted. Let's suppose, for example, that the delay is in the order of 10-100 milliseconds. Therefore, we could implement a Smith predictor using the approach that features the presence of memory cells. In the figure, you see the compensation architecture featuring the block equal to 1, to which the block implementing the delay is subtracted, and then we have the block with the integrator 1 on S. The only point that deserves to be clarified is the implementation of the delay, the exponential term, and we will have a sequence of registers, for example n equal to 100 cells, that can be synchronized with a clock equal to 100 microseconds, and in this case the delay that we are considering is 10 milliseconds. Clearly, 100 cells of memory is not a big spread of memory. Apart from this solution related to the delay of the process, the system can be considered stable. In the text, you see that a suitable choice of accelerometer to perform the measurement is required. What kind of accelerometer could we use for such a kind of measurement? The servo accelerometer with acceleration equal to 10 meter on squared second, not suitable. A moving mass maybe implemented as a MEMS transducer could be possible. Surely, the piezoelectric accelerometer could be considered okay. In this case, the answer should foresee the presence of the description of the architecture of the accelerometer, how it works, the principles on which it is based, together with the conditioning network. I have drawn in the solution two choices. The first is related to the moving mass accelerometer that must be followed by a linear position transducer plus a rectifier. Remember that the linear position transducer is supplied in alternate current. And the output of the rectifier will be connected to the input of the digital-to-analog converter. Remember that even the description of the conditioning network is necessary to describe completely the interfacing with the microprocessor. Another choice, as we said, is to employ the piezoelectric transducer. So we have to describe how it works, and the two possible conditioning networks that can be added to the transducer, since we know that we can amplify the charge that is distributed on the two plugs at the extremities of the transducer, or conversely, we could amplify the voltage difference at the two pin outs of the transducer itself. Depending on the particular choice that is made in the answer, we have to describe how the circuit works. And finally, how many bits will characterize the converter? In the text, we see that the requirement is to assure an accuracy equal to the 2%. Once more, we remember that 2% means that we have a maximum scale, a full scale equal to 100, and a tolerated error with this constraint equal to 2. That is, 100 divided by 2 is the number of the levels of the converter that will assure such a kind of relative error, such a kind of error in percentage. Therefore, we need 50 levels. And 50 levels means that the conversion of the ADC must be done using 6 bits of the data bus. Together, the other 2 bits, the start of conversion and at the end of conversion, that must be connected between converter and microprocessor to manage the handshake between the two partners. Finally, we take into account the 5 questions that are written at the end of the text. Typically, these questions don't require very wide answers, but since their aim is to verify if the mechanisms of a particular situation, of a particular device, has been captured, let's say, the point is very focused, is very narrow, and consequently the answer is very short. Let's consider the five questions that have been. The first question says, what characteristic of the unijunction transistor and of the connected components make it suitable for turning on a silicon controlled rectifier? We remember that the pulse that is needed to switch on a silicon controlled rectifier must be, or perhaps should be, quick and intense. In other words, what it is required by the SCR is a voltage signal whose amplitude is not low and whose duration is not large, not high. The circuit that we have described in the actuator section, I mean the circuit with the UJT transistor, the capacitor that was charged by a current crossing a p-channel MOS, while another n-channel MOS played the role of a switch that absorbs the current in the negative wave of the alternate signal and let the current to fill the capacitor in the positive wave. Okay, this circuit is suitable for switching on the SCR and is also capable of respecting such a kind of requirement. In fact, when the voltage accumulated by the capacitor is well beyond the threshold to activate the UJT, that is 2 on 3, the voltage applied to the collector of the UJT, to the anode of the UJT transistor. In this case, a very big current, if you remember, crosses the transistor itself. Very intense due to the avalanche phenomenon that happens in the PN junction at the emitter position in the UJT. This current, on the other hand, is provided by the many positive charges accumulated in that area, in the P portion of the emitter PN junction, but is provided, I mean this amount of charge, by the capacitor, and the intense current will rapidly empty the accumulated current in the capacitor. Therefore, the UJT is triggered by the voltage into the capacitor, but very fastly this charge will expire and the UJT will turn back off. So this circuit works exactly in the way that is needed by the SCR at its gate, intense and quick signal provided. The next question is, what causes may give rise to electrical losses and phase shifts in the direct current motor? This is a question that we have already seen in the other exercise that we have solved this morning. Again, we have to consider all those, let's say, passive components present in the motor. We talked about friction, we talked about inertia, and we talked about the inductive nature of the motor itself, since it is made by wires wound into a rotor so as to produce a big solenoidal circuit that gives origin to a consistent magnetic field. The question is focused on the electrical issues. Therefore, we neglect all the considerations related to the friction and inertia terms, and we concentrate on the fact that the inductive nature of the motor causes, we well remember, the presence of an inductor in the equivalent circuit of the motor itself, and therefore phase shifts between the voltage provided and the answer of the motor itself. Clearly, the wires will spread part of the provided energy in thermal energy, that is under the shape of heat, and this is the reason why in the equivalent circuit we have also introduced a resistor, a small resistor, that is in any case due to the nature of the wires of which the motor consists of. The third question relates to the fact that typically a stepper motor is not used to provide a torque. Clearly, this is a, let's say, technological choice. In other words, to provide a suitable torque for loads that are particularly, for example, heavy or very hard to be moved, requires a magnetic field that is as well big. And of course, this means that we will need big inductors suitably supplied with enough big power. That is, the stepper motor has been conceived for such a kind of role, for such a kind of task. The answer is no, because to such a kind of tasks, we have in the market already the direct current motor. Therefore, the stepper motor is conceived to allow accurate control on the rotation velocity of suitable objects together with their angular position. And for doing this, we have to use a very small and accurate electromechanic architecture that is not suitable with big powers, big inductors, big rotations. Therefore, the application field of the stepper motor is completely different than the application field of a direct current motor. And this means that for high velocities and for high torques applied to objects connected to the shaft of the motor, we will use the direct one. For accurate angular position determination or accurate angular velocity determination, we will use the stepper motor. The next question is related to the use of the Wheatstone bridge. In other words, the requirement is to specify what motivations, what reasons suggest the usage of such a kind of conditioning network. Of course, we refer to the slides that we have studied in the conditioning network section. But we can say, first of all, that the main characteristic of the Wheatstone bridge is to provide a differential measurement. You surely remember when we used the Wheatstone bridge after strain gauge, and in particular after a couple of strain gauges mounted on a process, so as one of them will be subject to let's say extension in its length, while the other one will be subject to a contraction of its length, and this will turn out in a increment of the resistance in the first case and a decrement of the resistance in the second case. The difference of these two values, of course included into a suitable circuit, provides a signal that is proportional to 2 times the variation of the resistance in each one of them. And this circuit is the Whetstone bridge that provides, together with such a kind of benefit, that is, reinforce the output of the transducer, the possibility of compensating those, parameters, those, in some cases, disturbances that affect the transducer measurement. Again, we can refer to the strain gauges, and we remember that for those transducers, we have a very peculiar sensibility to the temperature. Therefore, the answer of the transducer is different in the different seasons of the year, summer, then winter, and this is clearly not correct. Therefore, the idea is, let's use two transducers, as we said a few minutes before, let's consider them in a way so as one is subject to a positive stress and the other is subject to a negative stress, but in both of them part of the answer will be sensible to the temperature of the environment into which the transducers are located, so as to eliminate offset in both of them through a differential measurement like that provided by the Wheatstone bridge. And finally, we know that when we are at the beginning of the measurement, we modify some potentiometers located into the bridge so as the output in steady conditions is zero. That is, the Whetstone bridge refers the measurement to zero so as to highlight in output positive variations or negative variations with respect the rest situation into which the process doesn't receive any solicitation. The final question is very tightly related to the theory and in particular asks for an explanation of the so-called magnetic coupling and requires a description of those transducers that are based on it. About the magnetic coupling, we can remember in particular the Faraday-Neumann-Lenz law that says that when a variable magnetic field irradiates a closed wire on itself, like a coil could be, or like a solenoidal circuit could be, a suitable electromotive force will be generated into the wire, and this voltage will be proportional to the variation of the flux of the magnetic field in the time. This variation is evaluated through the derivative function, but the voltage will be equal to minus this variation, minus the result of the derivative function. This is a particular consideration added by Lenz that says that the answer of an electronic circuit into which a voltage is induced by the magnetic field acts so as to be in opposition to the origin that causes the presence of this voltage. This is property that you remember it has been particularly exploited in the so-called induction-based generator, into which, depending on the rotation of the transducer, and in particular depending on those two, virtual surfaces and the symmetric surfaces that we considered, the rotation clockwise or the rotation counterclockwise provoked a lower efficient surface with respect to the irradiation of the magnetic field, or conversely, an increase of the effective surface that is exposed to the irradiation of the magnetic field. And depending on the effective surface augments or diminishes, we will have an induced voltage in the second statoric circuit that will follow this movement in practice, corresponding to the rotation of the transducer itself, that is, with a sinusoidal or a cosinusoidal law. In such a way, we have also introduced the first transducer that comes in mind when we consider the magnetic coupling between two circuits. But we have other transducers that we have studied in the first, let's say, section of the course. For example, the linear position transducer, into which a magnetic rod that receives a magnetic field of a primary solenoidal circuit. For this reason, that rod is magnetized. Reflect this field towards other two secondary solenoidal circuits, one towards the upper direction and one towards the lower direction, so as the induced voltage in these circuits will provide also the direction into which the object connected to the rod is moving. And other transducers are based on such a kind of principle, for example, the tachometric dynamo or the variable reluctance circuit, and even the synchro that we have not explained in our course. Okay, that is the complete solution of the exam dating back at January 29, 2016. I suggest you to consider the issues that this exam presents, to analyze the answers that we have given, and to reflect on them so as to learn not only the solution but the methodology with which these exercises and these problems have been solved and must be approached. I would say that it is better to stop here for today. Tomorrow we will continue with other two exercises that will present different situations so as to understand how to manage them.